Hello and welcome to Little African News. My name is Mona Davids and I am the founder of Little African News, New York Voice, and Real Talk with Mona Davids. Today's episode is the first episode for the 2025 mayoral campaign season for our upcoming primaries this June, where we are interviewing the individual mayoral candidates. So welcome to our Meet the Candidate for 2025. Our first guest in our Meet the Candidate series this campaign season is State Senator Zelnor Myrie from Brooklyn, New York. So Zelnor, welcome to Little African News and Meet the Candidate. Thank you so very much for joining us today. And please tell our readers and our viewers about yourself. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Good to be with you, Mona. Good to join Little African News.
Zelnor, you are on mute.
Can you hear me? So I don't.
Okay, now I can hear you.
Now you can hear me. Okay. All right. We're all good. It is great to be with you, Mona. I'm glad to be joining Little African News and happy to talk about a little bit about myself and what my vision for the city is. But, you know, at heart, I'm someone who is the proud son of two Costa Rican immigrants. My parents came to New York City about 50 years ago, and both of them worked in factories when they got in the city. Like most people who come here, they came here to work, came here for opportunity. And my dad worked in a sponge making factory. My mom worked in a linen factory. My dad would go on to become a public school teacher. He taught special education in the Bronx for about 22 years before retiring. My mom became a nurse, was a healthcare professional, and actually a small business owner. She had a jewelry shop on Flatbush Avenue that she had open for a couple of years. They sent me to public schools in Brooklyn. I went to PS 161 in Crown Heights when I went to Brooklyn Tech for high school, went to Fordham for undergrad and grad school. I worked for the city council for a couple of years, and then I went to Cornell for law school. I was able to work at one of the most prestigious law firms in the world after Cornell. And then I ran for state senate to represent the very communities that my parents had come to close to 50 years ago. So it's been an honor to serve in the state senate, to be able to work on really important issues to the community, like affordable housing, like a safety on our streets, like our education system. And I'm excited at this moment to talk about what the future of this city should look like. My wife and I, who went to the same elementary school that I did, you know, we're trying to figure out our future here in the city. We're trying to figure out what it looks like to put down roots in the very community that we live in and that we were born and raised in. But it's too expensive. When we think about childcare and the cost of that and expanding a family, $22,000 per year per kid feels very much out of reach. And when we think about public safety, you know, I'm someone that has been taking public transit my whole life here in this city, but things feel different on our streets and on our subways. And instead of having a city hall that has been wholly focused on those solutions, we've had a city hall that has been in the headlines for some other reasons. And so I want a city that everyone can afford to stay here. I want pre-K and 3K not just until 2:30 p.m., but until 6 p.m. I want after school for everybody. I was the beneficiary of after school. It will not be here without it. I hope to provide that for every single family and young person in this city. And I want to solve crime. I want to clear every shooting. I want to return our police headcount to what it was pre-pandemic so that we can have a full public safety ecosystem. And I want to get people help who are going through mental challenges, posing a threat to themselves, and sometimes posing a threat to others. But we got to have courage and urgency and leadership in this moment. And that's what I'm trying to bring to City Hall.
No, thank you. You touched on so many important points and concerns that New Yorkers have. So I want to dive into some of them. So, you know, top of mind is public safety. You also mentioned the subways. We keep on hearing that crime is down. We keep on hearing that subway crime is down, but then we see the crime in the subway. We see the state of the subways. We hear that crime is down in the city. And I know sometimes you can play with numbers, you can play with statistics, but New Yorkers do not feel safe. So, you know, I don't know whether it's the perception that it's just unsafe or it's actually safe. I never did well with statistics, but the fact of the matter, Selno, is that New Yorkers do not feel safe above ground and New Yorkers do not feel safe below ground. So as mayor, what would be one of the first few actions that you would take to address the concern of New Yorkers?
I want to spend a little bit of time here, Mona, because as you said, this is top of mind for every single New Yorker. And there are a couple of things that are at work. You know, when something happens to you in the subway, even if that same exact thing happened to you above ground, it just feels worse in the subway. There's nowhere to go. You're in a moving cart. You're in a closed space. So it's really important that we pay attention to what happens. When you hear that crime is down, you may not feel that way because what's happening to you feels more intense when you are underground. And what we've seen is that the nature of the crimes that happen in our subways have also changed from what it was in the early 90s and the early 2000s. Now we see a lot more random physical attacks, whereas in the 90s and in the 2000s, it was more robbery-based. People were getting things stolen from them. Now we see felony assaults as one of the most primary crimes in our subway system. But we also see people that are very clearly going through some mental challenges who have not been receiving the help from the city that they need. And this should be confusing to New Yorkers because it is a small amount of individuals, between 2,000 and 3,000, that are going through a chronic mental illness. The city knows who these individuals are. In fact, many of our city agencies, whether that is the Department of Social Services, the Department of Homeless Services, the Department of Health and Mental Health, our Health and Hospitals Corporation, they all know who these individuals are. And in fact, there have been places and units allotted to help these individuals get permanent housing and be on the way to a true path to recovery. But these agencies do not speak to each other. They do not communicate regularly, and there's not a single point of accountability. What I want to do as mayor is to change that. I want all of those agencies not just to be under one deputy mayor, but I want to bring in our housing department into that fold so that I can call up my deputy mayor and say, how did you take this number from 2,000 down to 1,999 today? Who did you get into permanent housing and on a path to recovery? Because what we do now doesn't work. We send them to Rikers Island where they get worse, or we send them to the emergency room where they cycle out and they're right back on the subway or right back on the streets. I have proposed something called a stabilization center, which is a mix of what we've seen in some pilots like the clubhouse model in some places of the city, where we have people come in. And if you just need a fresh pair of socks and clothes and a shower, you can get that and you can be on your way. But if you need diagnosis and you need longer term care and you need medication and you need longer treatment, you will also be able to receive that there and be put on that path. I want to do that in every single borough. I want to help consolidate the jurisdictions that we have in our city agencies. And I want one person that is held accountable for this, because these are people that are suffering and New Yorkers are compassionate. We understand that. But our public spaces cannot be where people get the help that they need. There have to be other places for them to do that. And it is incumbent on city leadership to get it done.
No, thank you for this really clarifying your position on that. And one thing I do want to say is that it doesn't make sense that the problem with our mentally ill and our homeless is spread across multiple agencies, because nothing actually gets done. One of the things that a lot of New Yorkers talk about is the fact that there aren't enough facilities for people who are struggling with mental health issues. How would you address that? How did we get to this point where, you know, we don't have enough facilities?
Yeah, well, you know, the city used to have more facilities and more psychiatric beds, but there were policy decisions that were made by previous governors, previous mayors, to move away from that model and to close those facilities. And now we are where we are today, where we do not have enough of these places to treat individuals. And even the places that we do are facing some systemic obstacles. If you think about the incentives for a hospital to keep a patient, it is oftentimes a fiscal concern that they are grappling with. Will they get reimbursed for the services that they are providing? And right now, there is not that reimbursement structure. So the incentive is for them to diagnose and to move people out of the hospitals and the facilities as quickly as possible. I want to change that incentive dynamic, but I cannot do that alone as the mayor. I'm going to need some help from the state and the federal government. What I am willing to do is to front some of those costs initially so we can get a handle on the crisis and to say, look, we will back up, we will reimburse you for the services. If this person needs longer term treatment, if they need longer term attention, the city will pay for it. But that's not a sustainable model. We can't also just construct facilities with city funds. We're going to need some help from the state and federal government. I don't think we're going to get that much help from the federal government in this moment, but I think we're going to have conversations in future years about what resources and capital we can get so that we can have enough facilities. Because it's one thing to say we have to get people off the subways and the streets, but what happens after? That's just as important. If we do not have them get the care that they need, they're gonna end up right back where we found them.
Thank you. And just one final question with regards to safety and transportation. In Brooklyn, we just had a tragedy, every family's worst nightmare with the car accident and the mother and her two children. I don't know if the son is okay or, but we have a problem with speeding. The driver of that car should not have been on the road. What else can be done? Because New York City has already lowered the speed limit. We have, very low speed limits in school zones. But we have people like this woman who, I don't know, she must have racked up like 90 speeding tickets. I don't even know what to say. But a family, a community is devastated. You know, what else can be done? Because it seems like we continue to have tragedies like this. Vision Zero is not working. We need to do something else. We cannot continue to have lives lost, but it seems like the Department of Transportation is too busy taking away our parking spots. And I'm a driver, so I have a very big problem. They're taking our parking spots. This is something, you're in Brooklyn, you know what I'm talking about. Our parking spots are disappearing, and it's making it very difficult also, let me say, for our seniors who do drive, and when they go to the grocery store, it's hard to park. Whether it's Brooklyn or in Queens, it's hard. It's making life difficult for many people, but your Department of Transportation, how would you deal with this? And how would you work with Albany to really, really just fix it, stop it, more penalties, more fines? Like what else can be done?
You know, Mona, you hit it right on the head. This was an unspeakable tragedy. It truly is the worst nightmare for you to be walking with your family on a beautiful Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon and to be the victim of a reckless driver A family devastated, will never get that mom, children back. You have a son in critical condition who may never be the same. You think about what that community is going to think every time they walk on that same parkway and on that same roadway. And like a lot of reckless behavior, it is a small percentage of people that are responsible for an outsized amount of the impact. And it's the same with reckless drivers. 1% of drivers who have over 6 speeding tickets a year. And what we are trying to do in Albany, in my current role, my colleague, Senator Andrew Gonardes, introduced a bill that would go after this 1%, these super speeders. And what it would do is, once you hit that limit, that you would be required to put a mechanism in your car that won't allow you to go over the speed limit. And this is similar to what we have seen in other instances with drunk driving, some of the consequences and the penalties there. And this is something that has also been done in some other states. In fact, some states just recently this year passed a similar law. I think we have to do this. This shouldn't be a question. This is common sense. No one should be opposed to this because this driver, as you mentioned, had absolutely no business on the road. She literally had no business on the road. Her license was suspended, yet she was still driving. She was still able to go above the speed limit. But had this law been in effect, the one that I just referenced, she would not have physically been capable of going over the speed limit. So I'd like to see that get done this year. And if we do not accomplish it this year, I would be honored to work in conjunction with my colleagues in Albany as the next mayor to ensure that we get it done.
Thank you. So now I want to pivot to education. It's that time of the year in Albany. You guys are doing the budget, but it's also that time for mayoral control. So what is your position on mayoral control and the governance of New York City schools? Let's start with that. And as mayor, how do you envision your governance to be?
I'm a product of public schools. I'm a District 17 kid. I would not be who I am. I would not have made it to law school. I would not be a state senator if I didn't receive a world-class public school education. But the truth is, I got lucky as it related to Brooklyn Tech because my middle school teacher, my math teacher, for the first couple of weeks, said, I'm going to scrap the curriculum and I'm just going to prepare you for the specialized high school exam. And about 70% of my class got into a specialized high school exam because he took that initiative. But you should not have to be lucky to have a high quality education. And you shouldn't have to be lucky to have that opportunity. And so my broad governing philosophy is that your zip code will not determine the quality of your education. And that's the kind of leadership that I want to provide. As it relates to mayoral control, we had to vote on this last year to extend mayoral control. And I am supportive. I'm running for mayor. I would like to have control over our education department. And that's not to say that this is a perfect system. I went to school under both. I went to school under the previous Board of Education when there was not mayoral control. And I was also in public schools when it was first instituted under the Bloomberg administration. I think there were positives and negatives in both instances. One of the positives of the previous system was that there was more agency with the superintendents and the principals to do things that were catered to the communities and the students that were in those classrooms. There was more voice for parents, and I was the beneficiary of that. My middle school, as I mentioned to you, was under the previous governance system. But I also think that there needs to be a central point of accountability. I want people to be able to come up to me, the voters who elected me, and to say, Mr. Mayor, the schools are terrible. What are you going to do about it? And I want to be able to have a response to that and to be able to pull the levers of government to get it done. One of the things that I think has been a bright spot in this administration was the approach to reading and the science of reading and employing some new approaches to this that focuses on increasing our literacy rates. This should be a major source of embarrassment for us that we have such a low reading proficiency, particularly at the third and fourth grade levels, because we know what this indicates for students' success and their likelihood to remain in school going forward. So I'd like to continue that focus on increasing our literacy rates, but I also want to do something that I was the beneficiary of and that I spoke about at the top of this interview, and that's After School for All. We went through our COVID-19 once-in-a-century pandemic, and we had children that also had to go through that and have experienced learning loss, major interruption in social and pedagogical development, and we have just continued as if that has never happened. What I think After School for All could help with is making up for some of that learning loss, give our kids some opportunities to get additional help if they need it, but also to give them some other outlets if the academics is not their thing per se, to have them be creative, have them work on art, have them do things that are culturally appropriate that might exhibit their talent so that they can have the opportunity to thrive and restore that love for learning. Because what we have seen is an absentee rate that has not returned to what it was pre-pandemic. And that to me is a function of us not instilling that love for learning, but also not giving them a product that they want to be a part of and that they want to consume. So that is the type of education system that I want here in New York City, the one that I was the beneficiary of, the one that is the great equalizer for everyone, and the one that should not depend on what neighborhood you live in.
Thank you. So I just want to go back. So, all right. So there's no mayoral control this year.
So it is not up for a vote this year.
Next year.
Right. That's right. We extended it for 2 years.
Okay. Wonderful. So I want to just quickly touch on something that always does seem to come up every year. And that is, the SHSET, the Specialized High School Exam, the Heck-Calendra Act. And, you're an alum of a specialized high school. I'm the parent of also an alum of a specialized high school. And when I was growing up, not trying to date myself, but A lot of my classmates, I went to John Jay, but a lot of my classmates went to specialized high schools. We're talking the late 80s, mid to late 80s. So, there wasn't an issue with the specialized high school. So many people I know, it was normal to go to a specialized high school for folks in our community, but it's no longer a normal, the demographics. The question that I have for you is, granted, there's always an issue with the specialized high school. We see the results come out and they say, oh, it's only so many of Black students, so many Latinos, so many Asians, so many whites. But we now have more specialized high schools than what we had when I was in school. And, we under Heck-Calendra, Brooklyn Tech, Bronx Science, Brooklyn Tech, Bronx Science, which one is it? Stuyvesant. Oh, my gosh. Stuyvesant people would be so mad that I forgot Stuyvesant. And, of course, LaGuardia also falls under that act. But under Mayor Bloomberg, he added more specialized high schools. So my question to you, Zelnor, is one, do you support us having the specialized high school exam? And then also as mayor, would you add more specialized high schools? They've gotten rid of zoned high schools, which is a big problem because we have unsafe subways and then we have our kids having to travel on these unsafe subways. We used to have zoned high schools. They've taken that away. That falls under mayoral control. So, for parents, what would your plan be when it comes to high schools, specialized high schools, and do you support the SHSET?
Yeah. So, and thank you for the question. The like housing, like jobs, like childcare, education is about opportunity. It is about giving your kids the best opportunity that they can have to get the best education and to be on the path to great success. I was able to have opportunity because I did well on the test. My grades were not good in middle school. I was going through puberty. I was trying to impress girls. I was a big class clown. I was messing around in the middle school. And so the specialized high school exam was really my saving grace. It really changed the course of my life and allowed for me to play on equal footing with everyone else taking the test. So I do believe in the test. I do think that it serves as a real gateway. And you think about the population of a lot of these schools, it's a lot of immigrants. It is a lot of children of people who have come from all over the world who are themselves struggling and are just trying to get their foot in the door and doing what they know best. And that is, I'm going to give my kid every shot at success. And that is what the specialized high school exam has been for many people. Of course, it is concerning to me that the numbers look different than what they did in years past. And that's something that we have to really examine as a city. What sort of preparation are we giving our middle school students? What tutoring and test prep are we providing for many families that want this opportunity? You shouldn't have to work three jobs to be able to afford specialized high school test prep programming. And so I think that we should be taking a very hard look at that and to seeing how we're preparing. And, I'm not reflexively opposed to other admission conversations, but I do believe in the test. It was something that helped give me opportunity. And when we think about where people go to school, you know, you mentioned, Mona, about zone high schools. You know, back in my day, and then I guess I'm dating myself now, my zone school was Erasmus, and this was before it was split into different campuses. And for those of us who remember, Erasmus at that time was not a good school. Had I gone to Erasmus, my whole story would probably be different. I think when we talk about zone schools and the ability for people to travel to get better opportunities, I think, you know, that's a discussion worth having because we unfortunately have a school system where it does matter where you go to school and it does matter where you live. My goal and the goal, I think, of every leader in government should be that even if you had to go to the school right down your block, that you would still receive a high quality, world class education. That should be the ultimate mission. And that's going to be my mission as the next mayor.
Thank you. That's very good to know, because it's a concern for so many parents and so many of our students. And our zone school should be high quality schools. So Zelma, there's just two more things that I just want to touch on. Thank you again for being here and having this conversation with me. So housing. The rent is too damn high. This is for real. New York State is like number one for outward migration. In New York State, New York City is number one for outward migration. And the Bronx is the borough with the most outward migration. People are leaving. Yes, people leave for different reasons, but housing, affordable housing, where you can raise a family. This is a problem. It's just, it's too expensive and there isn't enough. So, you know, what are your proposed solutions? How will you tackle this as mayor?
Mona, this is the number one thing that I hear about when I talk to voters across the city. Say, I can't afford to stay here. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about leaving. I can't raise my family here. And it's not something that I'm only hearing from voters. This is in my own personal life. I grew up in Central Brooklyn, born and raised. And I was looking at some potential homes, and my wife and I are trying to figure out what path to home ownership we have. And there is nothing in Central Brooklyn under $1 million right now. It's out of reach for, and we're doing relatively well. It's out of reach for the average New Yorker. And we have to be as bold in the solutions as the scale of the problem. And we can't keep nibbling around the edges. The truth is, we have to build more housing, and we have to build housing of all types. The concept of supply and demand applies to housing as well. Right now, we have a situation where, because there are so few units available, there are few developers that get to benefit from this and have the median rent be at $4,000. Who can afford that? That can't be the city that we continue to live in. So I have proposed a mandate for 1 million homes over the next 10 years, and I want to do that in a couple of ways. I want to create 700,000 units over the next 10 years. And this is something we used to do in the 1920s and the 1930s. We were building 70,000 units every single year. And this was the solution to help bring down the cost for everybody. But we also have to protect the folks that are here that have made the city attractive in the first place. I grew up in a rent-stabilized apartment on Flatbush Avenue. My story is not possible without that. And I think it's important that if you are facing eviction, that you have a lawyer that can help you in that case. I want to expand that program. I want to fully fund it. I also want to protect our homeowners. We know our homeowners have been subject to deed theft, people literally defrauding them out of their ownership. I wrote a bill in Albany to make that a crime. It had not been a crime in this state for decades. We changed that this year. I want to expand that protection and allow for lawyers to help anyone facing deed theft or foreclosure. And I want to use our public land, city-owned land, some of our libraries, some of our other public institutions where we can build some housing there. Some affordable housing that people in the neighborhood can afford, and do that in an aggressive way all across the city so that we have a mix. We have a mix of both. We have mixed income developments. We have affordable developments. We got to have an all of the above approach in this moment. That is the only way that we're going to bring the housing cost down for everyone. And I'm not saying this is going to be easy, Mona. You know the difficulties in doing this, and the challenges and the opposition that you face. But we built the Empire State Building in 13 months in the 1920s during the Great Depression. Come on now. New York City can still do big things. This has to be the biggest thing we are focused on in this moment, because if not, we're going to have a city that we don't recognize, a city where you can't raise your family, and that can't be the city that I lead. And so I'm really going to be focused on this issue from day one, and I'm going to be hoping that New Yorkers will hold me accountable.
Thank you. Yeah, it's something needs to be done. Something really needs to be done. We cannot have our families fleeing, you know, fleeing the city. So last but not least, the topic that I want to bring up on behalf of all of us ethnic and community media publishers is, how are you going to improve the mayor's office of ethnic and community media? And for our readers and for our viewers who are going to watch this, we have a mayor's office of ethnic and community media. I'm just going to just quickly give background for our viewers. It was established under local law 83 in 2021. Before that, Mayor de Blasio had an executive order that required all city agencies to advertise at least 50% with ethnic and community media, because outlets such as Little African News, New York Carib News, Amsterdam News, and our other ethnic and community media outlets were not receiving city advertising. So thanks to Mayor de Blasio, we had an executive order that required that. Then local law 83 came into effect starting January 2022 under Mayor Adams. But under Mayor de Blasio, we were receiving advertising. A report came out Zelnor, thank you for commenting on it and for your support of ethnic and community media. But a report came out last week by Comptroller Bradlander, which said what we've been saying as ethnic and community media outlets. We're small businesses. We didn't touch on small business. We should touch on small business because that is important. So maybe one more if you have time. Mm-hmm. But we're small businesses. We're mom and pops. We're, many of us are immigrant-owned businesses. And we are here and we are engaging our communities. Our communities trust us to give them the news. Our communities, our immigrant communities, the majority in this city who also are registered voters, we don't read the New York Times. We don't read the New York Post. We don't read the New York Daily News. We read the Haitian Times. We read New York Carib News. We read Bangla Weekly. These are the things that we read. And according to the report of Comptroller Lander, advertising with ethnic and community media outlets under this administration has gone down 84%. And this is something that we've been complaining about, we've been raising. And it is down 84% when we finally have an office of ethnic and community media. We have a law that says that the city is required to advertise with us. They're not complying with the law. And we're not being paid on time. So as mayor, how are you going to fix the mayor's office of ethnic and community media? And will you be in compliance of the actual law?
First, thank you, Mona, for the work that you do with Little Africa News and the leadership that you have really been exhibiting on the ethnic and community news and doing the things that we need in this moment to highlight the issues that you guys care about. This is personal for me because, look, I grew up in Brooklyn. Every time I went to Golden Crest with my mom, anything that was on the windowsill, I grab, she's ordering, I'm grabbing what's on the windowsill and I'm catching up and seeing what's going on. When we would go to our restaurants and I'm getting some, you know, getting some oxtail, you know, they have it stacked up in our community centers, in after school, in our hair salons, in our barber shops. This is what our communities depend on to get news. And particularly for our immigrant communities, we're trying to figure out what's going on back home. And they're not covering that in our major publications here in this city. It is our community and ethnic news outlets that are covering this. These are literal lifelines to people's families, to the news that's happening, to paying attention to the things that no one else wants to talk about. So this is very simple for me. We will at minimum be complying with the law. I mean, that I think is a basic function. So city advertising dollars will be invested in accordance with the law to ensure that you get it. You know, sometimes people don't understand that in this modern media market, that your whole existence is dependent on your advertising dollars. You need that kind of support. And particularly when we have major search engines like Google and others that have really sucked up the oxygen in that space and have not allowed for you to be making money in that way. So I want to be in compliance with the law. But I also think that our community and ethnic news media outlets deserve a seat in Room 9. And for your viewers, Room 9 is where all of the reporters in the city get to be in City Hall. There is a room in City Hall for our news outlets. And I believe very strongly that our community and ethnic news outlets deserve their seat there as well. This, again, is to me paramount to us connecting to our communities, to meeting people where they are. And the city should be putting its money where its mouth is.
Yes. No, thank you for that, because for us, to be honest with you, yes, just compliance with the with the law, with the basic law is you know, that's what we asking for, because our communities rely on us to, you know, to keep them informed, to keep them civically informed, to let them know about programs, city services, and, you know, we should be supported. There shouldn't be multinational, multi-million dollar outlets getting city advertising that per the law is meant for us. That is simply what we're saying. And we hope that this is something that is top of mind for you as well. And regarding Room 9, yes, I just want to say, you may not know this, but in the history of Room 9, where we do have all of these, news outlets, newspapers, New York Times, all every one of them, for the first time in the history of New York City, Zelnor, the only Black-owned news outlet in the history of New York City that finally has a permanent desk in Room 9 is Little African News. So, and it shouldn't have taken this long. And I had to fight to get that permanent desk as the first only Black-owned news outlet in that room. And, we hope that I bring this up to you because these are things that, we hope that you will improve upon as mayor. And just last but not least, but you brought it up. So my final question for you is small businesses. Small businesses throughout the city are struggling. We need more support programs for small businesses. I know we have a so-called MWBE program, but I know a lot of small businesses owned by minorities, by immigrants, by women who are not benefiting from the so-called MWBE programs in New York City and in New York City government. So my question to you is, what are you going to do to help and support our small and micro businesses in New York City, our community businesses, our businesses, whether it's on Flatbush Avenue, Fordham Road? These are the businesses that drive our economy, and these are the businesses that employ members from our communities. They employ the people that live in these communities.
I mentioned it at the beginning of our interview here that my mom had a jewelry shop on Flatbush Avenue. And this was part of my mom's dream because like many immigrants that come here, we carry a hustling spirit with us. We're just trying to talk to people, get our goods out on the streets, interact with people and, have a smart sense of business and entrepreneurship. But my mom could only keep that shop open just a few years because she could not navigate the city bureaucracy. She did not have access to capital. There wasn't anything at the moment called MWBE. There was no outreach from anybody. She was just trying to figure it out all on her own. And I take that experience with me as the next mayor of the city because I think we have to be so much more proactive with our small business services. We got to go out to our communities. We got to provide as many opportunities as possible for people to come to us to say, look, I want to start this. How do I make this happen? How do I continue to be in existence? What are the access to capital routes for me? And I want to really bring City Hall to the community so that you don't have to be politically connected. You don't have to have some type of backdoor relationship in order to know how the system works. And so I want to be a lot more proactive. But I also released a Black agenda just this week. And part of my Black agenda in generating intergenerational wealth was to create a Black business accelerator fund to allow for people to have this access to continue to make their dreams a reality. There are some constitutional charter challenges there, but I think that we can have some charter amendments that will allow the city to give some micro grants, do that up front, to allow people to get on their feet initially, and then to continue to do all of the things that they already know how to do. it is a particularly important moment for our small businesses, because what we see coming out of the federal administration on the immigration front has had a lot of people stay inside. And, you know, formerly busy thoroughfares like Nostrand, like a Flatbush, like a Fordham Road, you know, out in Queens, we are seeing people not patronize these businesses as much because of fear of what's happening. And this is a time where our small businesses need more support than ever. You look at some of the things that worked during the pandemic. You looked at some of the abilities we had to get money out quickly, out the door, to change some regulations to allow for people to thrive as a business. We got to revisit some of those and see what capabilities the city has to boost them, because we talk often, as you mentioned, Mona, that the small businesses are the backbone of our city, but we don't give them the resources and the support that the backbone should have. This is something that is personal to me and that I really look forward to supporting as the next mayor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Selnor. I appreciate you taking the time to speak with me and speak with Little African News about your vision for New York City as mayor, and to really, you know, go deep and talk about the actions and what, you know, what you will do to improve the lives of New Yorkers. So thank you so very much for joining us at Little African News. And we hope that you will come back again before the primary and speak with us and tell us, you know, how things are going.
It really was my pleasure. I will most certainly be back if it's an open invitation. Thank you again for the work that you do with Little Africa News, and to all of your readers, to all of the viewers. Do not take this for granted. It is not easy to put this on. It is not easy to be consistent in delivering the news to the people. So thank you, Mona, and I'm looking forward to being back.
Thank you.
You got it.
Bye-bye.